first, when you think of 1970s rock music, you probably think a lot about Hair. This past year, music lost two of its most influential glam rockers, David Bowie, and an 80s musician influenced by him, Prince. Bowie, T-Rex, Roxy Music, and other glam rock idols were known for their fashion flair and gender bending.
In his new book, our guest follows the history of glam rock from its origins to its modern-day descendants.
Simon Reynolds joins us. His new book is Shock and Awe, A History of Glam Rock from the 70s to the 21st Century. Simon, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, let's try to do something that might be more difficult than it sounds and define glam rock. I assume there's a lot of blurriness around the edges, but what is the core of what glam rock was, maybe is?
Yeah, well, obviously, the glam is a bit of a clue. It's music that restates, often to an absurd degree, the visual aspects of music. That's where a lot of the coherence of glam rock as a phenomenon comes along, is with the sort of the glitter, the sort of art, you know, man-made, very shiny fabrics, the platform boots. I think of glam rock as having a sort of a sort of odd relationship with glamour. It's not exactly like conventional razzle dazzle, or it's not like, you know, a figure like Diana Ross would have been a glamorous, elegant performer in the 70s. It's not exactly like Hollywood glamour, like Grace Kelly or whatever. It refers to those things, though. You know, so say a group like Roxy Music, Brian Eno is wearing a lot of feathers, and that's like a reference to Marlene Dietrich, who would wear like the plumage of hundreds of birds who would die for her glamour, basically. Or fur, like Brian Ferry would wear like leopard pattern fabric, or tiger pattern fabric, and that's a reference, you know, to fur and the Hollywood idea of glamour. But the end result, if you look at the pictures of Roxy Music from that time, is quite absurdist. It's sort of like so there's an element of parody or travesty of glamour, I think, that's going on in glam. And then musically, I think what it is, you know, there's a weird kind of this visual excess, and then the music is quite pared down and focused. It's like killer anthemic rock and roll, with a danceable element. Like, a lot of this music was, you know, especially the more teenage lumpen end of glam, like Slade, The Sweet, Gary Glitter, this was music actually aimed to be played in the discotheques of that time. It was sort of disco music. Before disco came to mean what we understand it, which is primarily black music, Chic and Van McCoy, The Hustle, and Saturday Night Fever type music. Groups like The Sweet and Susie Quattro and Gary Glitter were stomping sort of tunes for the dance floor.
One thing that struck me, you write about Mark Bolan of T-Rex being influenced by Syd Barrett of early Pink Floyd era, and talking about the voice. This is an era when a lot of the English bands were trying to sound like American blues singers in some ways, and these were people singing in English voices. In some cases, like Syd Barrett, upper crust English voices. Was that important? Was this a more uniquely English rock than a derivative American rock taken to England?
Well, there's some key figures are American, you know, whether it's mm-hmm. Lou Reed, Alice Cooper, New York Dolls. But there is something very, very British and very, very English about glam. And it does pick up on the Englishness of Syd Barrett or Ray Davies or certain other 60s performers, and it just pushes it much further. I mean, Bowie is singing, the big influence on Bowie's singing early on is this guy Anthony Newley, who was a kind of music hall, music theatre, very, very English-sounding performer with a kind of Cockney voice, and you can hear that in the way Bowie sings. Bolan's picking up on what Syd Barrett, as you said, what Syd Barrett was doing, which was this sort of almost archaic English, harking back to the nursery room of the Victorian and Edwardian era, and sort of, you know, children's books, you know, were a big influence on both Syd Barrett and Mark Bolan. Mark Bolan was obsessed with The Hobbit and with Lord of the Rings and fantasy literature, you know, the Narnia books of C.S. Lewis, which is, you know, it's all very much like English children in a fantasy world. And that's kind of Bolan's thing, is he's like a boy child, you know, a man child in his songs in this fantasy world, which, you know, is equal parts psychedelia and Tolkien, I think.
Talking to Simon Reynolds. His new book is Shock and Awe, A History of Glam Rock from the 70s to the 21st Century. Well, let's give a little listen to Mark Bolan and T-Rex, one of the songs that I had heard of growing up a little bit later than you did. Here's Alyssa. So it's a live version of Get It On there. Let's talk about glam rock as a live performance, not just as a studio element.
Yes, it was very much... glam was initially a reaction. Part of what gives glam as a movement as its sort of coherence is that it's a reaction against what came before, which was a period when rock was not providing a lot of visual entertainment factor. You know, it was great albums made in the late 60s, but it was very much about, you know, the music's what matters. Brits were not putting on much of a show. They weren't dressing very interestingly. You know, it was all denim and sort of beards and a lot of in sort of... The performers would tend to be inwardly focused on stage, and they were, like, playing these long solos. And what people like Bowie, what Alice Cooper... Roxy Music, all in their different ways, were trying to bring back a bit of spectacle and a bit of showbiz. And it's this, the showbizification, to use a gruesome term, the drift towards showbiz was the sort of defining thing of the 70s. You got it outside glam with, you know, quite a few prog rock performers were very visual, whether it was Genesis, Peter Gabriel dressing as a fox, you know, or this strange deformed character with bulbous protrusions coming off his face called the Slipper Man. Jethro Tull were quite visual, but glam kind of was the main force for this sort of let's have something for people to kind of gawp at and goggle at, you know, and stare in amazement at. And Alice Cooper took it in his own unique way, which was
grotesquery in a thing, way, yeah.
Yeah, and this term grand Greenwall, which is a term rock critics bandy around. I've used it for years. I never actually bothered to look up what it was, but it was a French theatre where people staged very realistic-looking murders and psychosis and all kinds of horrible things on stage, and the audience would be electrified by it. And that's kind of what Alice Cooper translated to the arena circuit with his hair-raisingly realistic executions of himself, starting with electric chair that he built himself because they didn't have much money to start with, and then as the funding came in, they had a very realistic gallows hanging himself on stage, and then the pièce de résistance was a guillotine with Alice Cooper being decapitated on stage. But they had loads of other stunts. It was getting increasingly choreographed and with props and all the trappings of showbiz. So this was like a big reaction against the dominant thing before glam, which was singer-songwriter music or progressive rock or boogie bands, which were very visually kind of drab.
You know, gender identity is still an issue of political controversy in the U.S. now, in 2016. The glam rock era, this was a big part of it, androgyny among especially the male performers. Why was that such a central thing for so many of them?
I think there's a bunch of things. I think it picked up on the androgyny of the 60s, which you saw with the Rolling Stones and various other groups of that time, having hair that now seems very normal, but it's just a few extra inches.
I have longer hair than those guys, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to recover in some ways, the shock of a couple of extra inches of hair had people, you know, aghast and like, are you, you know, or confused, you know, are you a boy, are you a girl? The Stones wore some makeup at times. So it was the 60s thing, but it was taken to the next level, especially by Bowie, who, it's only a few years after homosexuality has become legal in Britain, like 2 or 3 years, and he's sort of saying, asserting that he, you know, in a famous interview with Merger Maker, he said, I am gay and I always have been. A bit of an exaggeration, something of a publicity stunt, but certainly as a statement, very sort of bold in the entertainment world at that time, and liberating to a lot of people, whether it was gay people awakening to their sexuality, who now had a pop star explicitly saying, rather than leaving little clues and hints like earlier pop stars maybe had done, like the certain Kink songs like Lola, it was just a very bold, strident statement that they felt, you know, they've got someone representing them, and that helps them to come out, and, you know, later they'll become the pop stars of the 80s, like Boy George, are very much the children those sort of British synth pop bands and 80s New Romantics. They're very much the children of Bowie and glam. But I think also it was exciting, you know, for girls. I think it's this thing of the appeal of the boy who's very pretty and takes care of his appearance and seems to be gentle and sort of somewhere between the genders. That's very attractive. For straight men, there's also something liberating to the idea of being a dandy, of being I can explore this area. Maybe I never act on it, but the idea that you're attracted aesthetically to someone like Bowie or Bolan, you know, that sort of, you feel a fluidity within yourself, a sort of potential. It may never come to anything, but it's liberating. So I think a lot of, you know, I interviewed a lot of people who were like fans of glam, who like experimented with makeup, who tried to put on their mother's clothing in some cases when they went out to see Bowie or Mott the Hoople play.
As we wrap up, you mentioned the children of the glam rock era. Who are the grandchildren today?
Well, Lady Gaga, when she first emerged, was very like explicit about presenting herself as a self-conscious inheritor of glam. She thanks Bowie in the liner notes of her debut album, The Fame. Kesha actually wore a lot of glitter in her image and has collaborated with Alice Cooper and has talked about being a fan of T-Rex. I think a lot of mainstream pop, you can see these echoes of it. I actually hear it in a weird way in a lot of rap, because one of the defining things about glam was that a lot of the lyrics were about being a star and being famous. And so much rap today, you know, Drake became famous with an album about becoming famous. Kanye West, big topic is fame, you know. His one of his most controversial recent things was the video for the song Famous. So there's a kind of, you know, it echoes Warhol. Warhol was a big sort of influence on Bowie and on Roxy Music, and this whole idea of fame is like this huge cultural fact, this fantasy trip that so many of us are fascinated by, aspire to, and yet it nearly always goes wrong. There's abundant literature that being famous really messes with your head, and that people who become famous often regret it. So this idea of fame as the subject of pop music itself, I think, is the thing that connects a lot of, you know, Lady Gaga's album was called The Fame, and then she did an expanded version of it called The Fame Monster, you know. So that creates the idea of fame turning you into a monster. Or perhaps you need to be a little bit of a egomaniac or monster in the first place to want to be famous.
Simon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Simon Reynolds, music critic, author of the book Shock and Awe, A History of Glam Rock from the 70s to the 21st Century.